the cap, and he thought of love that would never be given or received, and he thought of all the genius puppies who would never be born, and the weight of all that loss nearly crushed him into the ground. He used his grief to sharpen his rage, honed his fury until it had a razored edge. Then he went to the barn. The place swarmed with shadows. He stood at the open door, letting the rain beat on his head and back, peering into the barn, squinting at the layered gloom, hoping to spot the yellow eyes. Nothing. He went through the door, bold with rage, and sidled to the light switches on the north wall. Even when the lights came on, he could not see the outsider. Fighting off dizziness, clenching his teeth in pain, he moved past the empty space where the truck belonged, past the back of the Toyota, slowly along the side of the car. The loft. He would be moving out from under the loft in a couple of steps. If the thing was up there, it could leap down on him. That speculation proved a dead end, for the outsider was at the back of the barn, beyond the front end of the Toyota, crouched on the concrete floor, whimpering and hugging itself with both long, powerful arms. The floor around it was smeared with its blood. He stood beside the car for almost a minute, 15 feet from the creature, studying it with disgust, fear, horror, and a weird fascination. He believed he could see the body structure of an ape, maybe a baboon, something in the simian family anyway. But it was neither mostly one species, nor merely a patchwork of the recognizable parts of many animals. It was instead a thing unto itself, with its oversized and lumpish face, immense yellow eyes, steam shovel jaw, and long curved teeth, with its hunched back and matted coat and two long arms. It attained a frightful individuality. It was staring at him, waiting. He took 2 steps forward, bringing up the gun. Lifting its head, working its jaws, it issued a raspy, cracked, slurred, but still intelligible word that he could hear even above the sounds of the storm. "Hurt!" Travis was more horrified than amazed. The creature had not been designed to be capable of speech, yet it had the intelligence to learn language and to desire communication. Evidently, during the months it pursued Einstein, that desire had grown great enough to allow it to conquer, to some extent, its physical limitations. It had practiced speech, finding ways to wring a few tortured words from its fibrous voice box and malformed mouth. Travis was horrified, not at the sight of a demon speaking, but at the thought of how desperately the thing must have wanted to communicate with someone, anyone. He did not want to pity it, did not dare pity it, because he wanted to feel good about blowing it off the face of the earth.
"Come far, now done,"
it said with tremendous effort, as if each word had to be torn from its throat. Its eyes were too alien ever to inspire empathy, and every limb was unmistakably an instrument of murder. Unwrapping one long arm from around its body, it picked up something that had been on the floor beside it, but that Travis had not noticed until now. One of the Mickey Mouse tapes Einstein had gotten for Christmas. The famous mouse was pictured on the cassette holder, wearing the same outfit he always wore, smiling that familiar smile, waving.
"Mickey,"
the outsider said, and as wretched and strange and barely intelligible as its voice was, it somehow conveyed a sense of terrible loss and loneliness.
"Mickey."
Then it dropped the cassette and clutched itself and rolled back and forth in agony. Travis took another step forward. The outsider's hideous face was so repulsive that there was almost something exquisite about it. In its unique ugliness, it was darkly, strangely seductive. This time, when the thunder crashed, the barn lights flickered and nearly went out. Raising its head again, speaking in that same scratchy voice but with cold, insane glee, it said,
"Kill dog, kill dog, kill dog,"
and it made a sound that might have been laughter. He almost shot it to pieces. But before he could pull the trigger, the outsider's laughter gave way to what seemed to be sobbing. Travis watched, mesmerized. Fixing Travis with its lantern eyes, it again said,
"Kill dog, kill dog, kill dog."
But this time it seemed racked with grief, as if it grasped the magnitude of the crime that it had been genetically compelled to commit. It looked at the cartoon of Mickey Mouse on the cassette holder. Finally, pleadingly, it said,
"Kill me."
Travis did not know if he was acting more out of rage or out of pity when he squeezed the trigger and emptied the Uzi's magazine into the outsider. What man had begun, man now ended. When he was done, he felt drained. He dropped the carbine and walked outside. He could not find the strength to return to the house. He sat down on the lawn, huddled in the rain, and wept. He was still weeping when Jim Keane drove up the muddy lane from the coast highway. Chapter 11, Part 1. On Thursday afternoon, January 13th, Lem Johnson left Cliff Soames and three other men at the foot of the dirt lane, where it met the Pacific Coast Highway. Their instructions were to allow no one past them, but to remain on station until and if Lem called for them. Cliff Soames seemed to think this was a strange way to handle things, but he did not voice his objections. Lem explained that since Travis Cornell was an ex-Delta man with considerable combat skills, he ought to be handled with care. "If we go storming in there, he'll know who we are as soon as he sees us coming, and he might react violently. If I go in alone, I might be able to get him to talk to me, and maybe I can persuade him to just give it up." That was a flimsy explanation for his unorthodox procedure, and it did not wipe the frown off Cliff's face. Lem didn't care about Cliff's frown. He went in alone, driving one of the sedans, and parked in front of the bleached wood house. Birds were singing in the trees. Winter temporarily relaxed its hold on the Northern California coast, and the day was warm. Lem climbed the steps and knocked on the front door. Travis Cornell answered the knock and stared at him through the screen door before saying, "Mr. Johnson, I suppose?" "How did you—" "Oh yes, of course. Garrison Dilworth would have told you about me that night he got his call through." To Lem's surprise, Cornell opened the screen door. "You might as well come in." Cornell was wearing a sleeveless t-shirt, apparently because of a sizable bandage encasing most of his right shoulder. He led Lem through the front door and into a kitchen, where his wife sat at the table, peeling apples for a pie. "Mr. Johnson," she said. Lem smiled and said, "I'm widely known, I see." Cornell sat at the table and lifted a cup of coffee. He offered no coffee to Lem. Standing awkwardly for a moment, Lem eventually sat with them. He said, "Well, it was inevitable, you know. We had to catch up with you sooner or later." She peeled apples and said nothing. Her husband stared into his coffee. What's wrong with them? Lem wondered. This was not remotely like any scenario he had imagined. He was prepared for panic, anger, despondency, and many other things, but not for this strange apathy. They did not seem to care that he had at last tracked them down. He said, "Aren't you interested in how we located you?" The woman shook her head. Cornell said, "If you really want to tell us, go ahead and have your fun." Frowning, puzzled, Lem said, "Well, it was simple. We knew that Mr. Dilworth had to have called you from some house or business within a few blocks of that park north of the harbor. So we tied our own computers into the telephone company's records, with their permission, of course, and put men to work examining all the long-distance calls charged to all the numbers within 3 blocks of that park on that one night. Nothing led us to you. But then we realized that when charges are reversed, the call isn't billed to the number from which the call is placed. It appears on the records of the person who accepts the reverse charges, which was you. But it also appears in a special phone company file, so they'll be able to document the call if the person who accepted the charges later refuses to pay. We went through that special file, which is very small, and quickly found a call placed from a house along the coast, just north of the beach park, to your number here. When we went around to talk to the people there, the S&B family, we focused on their son, a teenager named Tommy, and although it took some time, we ascertained that it had indeed been Dilworth who used their phone. The first part was terribly time-consuming, weeks and weeks, but after that, Child's play. Do you want a medal or what? Cornell asked. The woman picked up another apple, quartered it, and began to strip off the peel. They were not making this easy for him, but then his intentions were much different from what they would be expecting. They could not be criticized for being cool toward him when they did not yet know that he had come as a friend. He said, "Listen, I've left my men at the end of the lane. Told them you might panic, do something stupid, if you saw us coming in a group. But why I really came alone was to make you an offer." They both met his eyes at last, with interest. He said, "I'm getting out of this goddamn job by spring. Why I'm getting out, you don't have to know or care. Just say that I've gone through a sea change. Learned to deal with failure. Now it doesn't scare me anymore." He sighed and shrugged. "Anyway, the dog doesn't belong in a cage. I don't give a good goddamn what they say, what they want. I know what's right. I know what it's like being in a cage. I've been in one most of my life until recently. The dog shouldn't have to go back to that. What I'm going to suggest is that you get him out of here now, Mr. Cornell. Take him off through the woods, get him somewhere that he'll be safe, then come back and face the music. Say that the dog ran off a couple months ago in some other place, and you think he must be dead by now, or in the hands of people who are taking good care of him. There'll still be the problem of the outsider, which you must know about. But you and I can work up a way to deal with that when it comes. I'll put men on the surveillance of you, but after a few weeks I'll pull them. Say it's a lost cause." Cornell stood up and stepped to Lem's chair. With his left hand, he grabbed hold of Lem's shirt and hauled him to his feet. "You're 16 days too late, you son of a bitch." "What do you mean?" "The dog is dead. The outsider killed him, and I killed the outsider." The woman laid down her paring knife and a piece of apple. She put her face in her hands and sat forward in her chair, shoulders hunched, making soft, sad sounds. "Ah, Jesus," Lem said. Cornell let go of him. Embarrassed, depressed, Lem straightened his tie, smoothed the wrinkles out of his shirt. He looked down at his pants, brushed them off. "Ah, Jesus," he repeated. Cornell was willing to lead them to the place in the forest where he had buried the outsider. Lem's men dug it up. The monstrosity was wrapped in plastic, but they didn't have to unwrap it to know that it was Yarbek's creation. The weather had been cool since the thing had been killed, but it was getting rank. Cornell would not tell them where the dog was buried. "He never had much of a chance to live in peace," Cornell said sullenly. "But by God, he's going to rest in peace now. No one's going to put him on an autopsy table and hack him up. No way. In a case where the national security is at stake, you can be forced—" "Let them," Cornell said. "If they haul me up before a judge and try to make me tell them where I buried Einstein, I'll spill the whole story to the press. But if they leave Einstein alone, if they leave me and mine alone, I'll keep my mouth shut. I don't intend to go back to Santa Barbara to pick up as Travis Cornell. I'm Hyatt now, and that's what I'm going to stay. My old life's gone forever. There's no reason to go back. And if the government's smart, it will let me be Hyatt and stay out of my way." Lem stared at him a long time. Then, "Yeah, if they're smart, I think they'll do just that." Later that day, as Jim Keane was cooking dinner, his phone rang. It was Garrison Dilworth, whom he had never met, but had gotten to know during the past week by acting as liaison between the attorney and Travis and Nora. Garrison was calling from a payphone in Santa Barbara. "They show up yet?" the attorney asked. "Early this afternoon," Jim said. "That Tommy Essenby must be a good kid." "Not bad, really. But he didn't come to see me and warn me out of the goodness of his heart. He's in rebellion against authority. When they pressured him into admitting that I made the call from his house that night, he resented them. As inevitably as billy goats ram their heads into board fences, Tommy came straight to me." "They took away the outsider. What about the dog?" "Travis said he wouldn't show them where the grave was. Made them believe that he'd kick a lot of ass and pull down the whole temple on everyone's heads if they pushed him." "How's Nora?" Dilworth asked. "She won't lose the baby." "Thank God. That must be a great comfort." Part 2. 8 months later, on the big Labor Day weekend in September, the Johnson and Gaines families got together for a barbecue at the sheriff's house. They played bridge most of the afternoon. Lem and Karen won more often than they lost, which was unusual these days, because Lem no longer approached the game with the fanatical need to win that had once been his style. He had left the NSA in June. Since then, he had been living on the income from the money he had long ago inherited from his father. By next spring, he expected to settle on a new line of work, a small business of some kind, in which he would be his own boss, able to set his own hours. Late in the afternoon, while their wives made salads in the kitchen, Lem and Walt stood out on the patio, tending to the steaks on the barbecue.
"So you're still known at the agency as the man who screwed up the Banodyne crisis?"
"That's how I'll be known until time immemorial."
"Still get a pension, though," Walt said.
"Well, I did put in 23 years.
Doesn't seem right, though, that a man could screw up the biggest case of the century and still walk away at 46 with a full pension. 3/4 pension.
Walt breathed deeply of the fragrant smoke rising off the charring steaks.
"Still, what is our country coming to? In less liberal times, screw-ups like you would have been flogged and put in the stocks, at least."
He took another deep whiff of the steaks and said,
"Tell me again about that moment in their kitchen."
Lem had told it 100 times, but Walt never got tired of hearing it again.
Well, the place was neat as a pin. Everything gleamed, and both Cornell and his wife were neat about themselves, too. They're well-groomed, well-scrubbed people.
"So they tell me the dog's been dead 2 weeks, dead and buried. Cornell throws this angry fit, hauls me out of my chair by my shirt, and glares at me like maybe he's going to rip my head off. When he lets go of me, I straighten my tie, smooth my shirt, and I look down at my pants, sort of out of habit, and I notice these golden hairs. Dog hairs. Retriever hairs, sure as hell. Now, could it have been that these neat people, especially trying to fill their empty days and take their minds off their tragedy, didn't find the time to clean the house in more than 2 weeks?
Hairs were just all over your pants, Walt said. 100 hairs. Like the dog had just been sitting there minutes before he came in. Like if I'd been 2 minutes sooner, I'd have sat right down on the dog himself.
Walt turned the steaks on the barbecue.
"You're a pretty observant man, Lem, which ought to have taken you far in the line of work you're in. I just don't understand how, with all your talents, you managed to screw up the Banodyne case so thoroughly."
They both laughed, as they always did.
"Just luck, I guess," Lem said,
which was what he always said. And he laughed again. Part 3. When James Garrison Hyatt celebrated his 3rd birthday on June 28th, his mother was pregnant with his 1st sibling, who eventually became his sister. They threw a party at the bleached wood house on the forested slopes above the Pacific. Because the Hyatts would soon be moving to a new and larger house a bit farther up the coast, they made it a party to remember, not merely a birthday bash, but a goodbye to the house that had first sheltered them as a family. Jim Keane drove in from Carmel with Pooka and Sadie, his 2 black labs, and his young golden retriever, Leonardo, who was usually called Leo. A few close friends came in from the real estate office where Sam, Travis to everyone, worked in Carmel Highlands, and from the gallery in Carmel where Nora's paintings were exhibited and sold. These friends brought their retrievers, too, all of them 2nd litter offspring of Einstein and his mate Minnie. Only Garrison Dilworth was missing. He had died in his sleep the previous year. They had a fine day, a grand time, not merely because they were friends and happy to be with one another, but because they shared a secret wonder and joy that would forever bind them into one enormous extended family. All members of the 1st litter, which Travis and Nora could not have borne adopting out, and which lived at the bleached wood house, were also present. Mickey, Donald, Daisy, Huey, Dewey, Louie. The dogs had an even better time than the people, frolicking on the lawn, playing hide-and-seek in the woods, and watching videotapes on the TV in the living room. The canine patriarch participated in some of the games, but he spent much of his time with Travis and Nora, and as usual stayed close to Minnie. He limped, as he would for the rest of his life, because his right hind leg had been cruelly mangled by the outsider, and would not have been usable at all if his vet had not been so dedicated to the restoration of the limb's function. Travis often wondered whether the outsider had thrown Einstein against the nursery wall with great force, and then had assumed he was dead. Or at the moment when it held the retriever's life in its hands, perhaps the thing had reached down within itself and found some drop of mercy, that its makers had not designed into it, but which had somehow been there anyway. Perhaps it remembered the one pleasure it and the dog had shared in the lab, the cartoons. And in remembering the sharing, perhaps it saw itself for the first time as having a dim potential to be like other living things. Seeing itself as like others, perhaps it then could not kill Einstein as easily as it had expected. After all, with a flick of those talons, it could have gutted him. But though he had acquired the limp, Einstein had lost his tattoo in his ear, thanks to Jim Keane. No one could ever prove that he was the dog from Banodyne, and he could still play dumb dog very well when he wished. At times during young Jimmy's third birthday extravaganza, Minnie regarded her mate and offspring with charmed befuddlement, perplexed by their attitudes and antics. Although she could never fully understand them, no mother of dogs ever received half the love that she was given by those she'd brought into the world. She watched over them, and they watched over her, guardians of each other. At the dark end of that good day, when the guests were gone and Jimmy was asleep in his room, when Minnie and her first litter were settling down for the night, Einstein and Travis and Nora gathered at the pantry off the kitchen. The Scrabble tile dispenser was gone. In its place, an IBM computer stood on the floor. Einstein took a stylus in his mouth and tapped the keyboard. The message appeared on the screen. "They grow up fast." "Yes, they do," Nora said. "Yours faster than ours." "One day they will be everywhere." "One day, given time and a lot of litters," Travis said, "they'll be all over the world." "So far from me, it's a sadness." "Yes, it is," Nora said. "But all young birds fly from the nest sooner or later." "And when I'm gone?" "What do you mean?" Travis asked, stooping and ruffling the dog's thick coat. "Will they remember me?" "Oh, yes, Furface," Nora said, kneeling and hugging him. "As long as there are dogs, and as long as there are people fit to walk with them, they will all remember you."
Afterword by Dean Kuntz. This afterword was written 15 years ago, in 2003, to accompany a print reissue, but what I said then is even more relevant today. The difference this time is that I'm narrating it at the insistence of my audio editor, who shall remain nameless, because after all, it is not his job to share the limelight, only to cajole me into doing things I would never otherwise consider. So what's the big deal? You get to hear it in my voice, which is about as suitable for this task as it would be for singing the title role in Pagliacci at New York's Metropolitan Opera, but it is just an afterword. So relax. However, I record this on an auspicious occasion, a new recording of, arguably, my most beloved novel, to coincide with Watchers being featured in PBS's Great American Read program's Top 100 Books. This honor pleases me infinitely more than did the four films supposedly based on the novel. Let's just call them mismade, repulsive, tedious, and witless. Rather than watch one of them again, I would rather have my hand nailed to a table with a railroad spike. Happily, Watchers has survived mutilation by film, and now we have a new recording, 30 years later, performed by Eduardo Ballerini. In over 120 editions, Watchers has sold 11 million copies worldwide and has remained in print for more than 32 years. The PBS Great American Reads program and this recording will bring Watchers to new ears and eyes. Or, as my audio editor is always prattling, good audio makes the ear an eye. So, if I am fortunate enough to live to such an advanced age that my wardrobe consists entirely of bathrobes, loose jumpsuits, bunny slippers, and adult diapers, and if I am also fortunate enough to be writing novels in the twilight of my life, I know that I can expect to receive mail from readers that says, in essence, "I love your new book, but that story you wrote when you were just a puppy, Watchers, is still the best thing you've ever done." I'll be at a book signing, accompanied by a nurse and by an attendant holding an ear trumpet, hooked to an IV drip feeding me liquefied nachos, wearing a lavishly embroidered jumpsuit more dazzling than anything Elvis ever wore during his Las Vegas period, And as readers greet me and receive their inscribed copies of my latest effort, a significant percentage of them will ask me to write a sequel to Watchers. I will smile, promise to think about it, try not to drool, and explain that I don't believe in writing a sequel to a book unless I can be sure it will be at least the equal of the original. For years after finishing the story of Einstein, the genetically engineered golden retriever with wildly enhanced intelligence, and his friends, I wondered if I would ever write another book that was as personally satisfying to me as this one had been. When I'm writing a novel, I experience bleak spells of deep self-doubt about my work, moments of surging confidence, despair followed by joy, although there are usually more dark moments than bright. With Watchers, however, I knew only joy. The desire to write well can never be fulfilled without hard work, and Watchers involved as many hours at the keyboard and as much struggle as any book I've done. But in this case, all the time and effort was pure pleasure, because I was aware that I had a grip on a unique idea, special material, and a group of characters whose depth and warmth were greater than those in any book I'd written to that time. For days at a stretch, I found myself in what psychologists call a flow state, a condition in which one performs far beyond what previously seemed to be the peak of one's abilities. With greater fluency and speed and grace, it is similar to what athletes mean when they say they're in the zone. Eventually, I wrote a few books I liked as well as Watchers. But to date, as I compose this essay, I can't honestly say I've written one that I like better. I remain confident that day will come. I am an eternal optimist. I believe the greatest scientists of our time will soon discover a cure for gnarly oak fungus and perfect a process to make Brussels sprouts taste like peanut butter. I believe that one day society will become so compassionate that Bigfoot will finally be able to come out of hiding and will be welcomed as a neighbor in any community in this land, as long as he showers regularly. And if that day comes, I suspect Mr. Foot will show up at a book signing to personally congratulate me when I do, at last, write a book that is a better performance than Watchers, because, judging by the fleeting glimpses we've had of him over the years, he seems like a shy, kind soul. If I've misjudged him, and if he tears my arm off for lunch, I will be dismayed, but I'll not be less optimistic and will not stop striving, albeit with only five fingers, to write a better book than this tale of Einstein. In an annotated bibliography in the Dean Koontz Companion, a book about my work, the bibliographer made the following observation about Watchers. Quote, "It embodies all of the major themes with which Koontz has been obsessed, the healing power of love and friendship, the struggle to overcome the past and change what we are, the moral superiority of the individual over the workings of the state and large institutions, the wonder of both the natural world and the potential of the human mind, the relationship of mankind to God, transcendence, and how we sustain hope in the face of our awareness that all things die. Those are indeed the fundamental issues in this novel." For the most part, as I have written the essays for this series of editions, I have tried to keep them light and amusing because, although I take my work seriously, I never take myself seriously. The human species is a parade of fools, after all, and I am often at the front of the parade, twirling a baton. Nevertheless, for a moment here, I will wax serious and then the car, because Watchers is so close to my heart. I believe that we carry within us a divinely inspired moral imperative to love, and I explore that imperative in all of my books. In Watchers, this issue is central to the story, and I even post signs announcing the theme, such as those embodied in the epigraphs that are used at the start of Part 2. Quote, "Love alone is capable of uniting living beings in such a way as to complete and fulfill them, for it alone takes them and joins them by what is deepest in themselves." Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And, quote, "Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends," the Gospel according to St. John. We have within us the ability to change for the better and to find dignity as individuals rather than as drones in one mass movement or another. We have the ability to love, the need to be loved, and the willingness to put our own lives on the line to protect those we love, and it is in these aspects of ourselves that we can glimpse the face of God, and through the exercise of these qualities, we come closest to a godlike state. With that said, my greatest hope is not that you find the themes of this novel worth analyzing, but that you find this to be a rip-roaring, rattling good story. I hope it keeps you so far out on the edge of your chair that you have butt bruises from repeatedly falling to the floor. I hope it makes you laugh and cry. A novel can have multiple intricately woven levels of theme and symbol, but it fails if it is not first a wonderful tale. When I'm Ancient, if you come to one of my book signings and see me sitting there in a pink terry cloth bathrobe or in a jumpsuit embroidered with scenes from the life of Mo Howard of the Three Stooges, I'll be happy to hear any kind words you whisper into my ear trumpet, even if it is only to say that my finest hour was with Watchers, this tale of a hero with a tale of his own. If Bigfoot is in line near you, however, I would also ask that you do me the service of determining that he's in a good mood and has already eaten lunch.
We hope you've enjoyed our presentation of Watchers by Dean Koontz, performed by Eduardo Ballerini. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.